cases, both confirmed and probable, 8,206. Ector County negative, 29,840 out of 38,599 tested, with 553 pending, 130 deaths. Recovered, 6,249. Active, 1,827. ECISD daily cases, 11 students, 10 staff. Midland County, 6,405 confirmed, 110 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 1,219 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 17th, 10,826 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 1,671 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 17th, 7,841 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 23 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 17th, 117 new deaths were recorded. West Texas Intermediate today is trading at $42.04, which is up 61 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The coronavirus vaccine being developed by Pfizer and German biotechnology firm BioNTech is 95% effective at preventing disease, and an application for emergency use authorization will be submitted within days, according to a news release from the companies. The announcement came hours after the FDA authorized the first rapid coronavirus test that can be taken at home and can deliver results within minutes, potentially allowing people to skip long lines at testing sites. The number of Americans willing to take a vaccine when one becomes available increased in the second half of October, according to a Gallup poll released Tuesday. The average number of daily patients dying of COVID-19 in the United States has reached a level not seen since the outbreak surged during the summer. At least 247,000 fatalities and nearly 11.4 million infections have been reported nationwide since February. Delta Airlines says it will keep blocking middle seats through March. Now here are some short articles. BioNTech is working on a vaccine formula that can be shipped at room temperature. From CNN's Frederick Platen, Claudia Otto, and Vasco Cotovio. The German biotech company, BioNTech, is working on a formula for its vaccine that would allow it to be shipped at room temperature, CEO Uğur Sayan told CNN's Frederick Platen in an exclusive interview on Wednesday. We are working on formulation which could allow us to ship the vaccine even maybe at room temperature, and this type of development is happening in parallel, Sahin said. Concerns were raised that it would be difficult to distribute the vaccine BioNTech is working on with the U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer because it needs to be stored at minus 75 degrees Celsius, which is about 50 degrees colder than any vaccine currently used in the United States. Doctors' offices, pharmacies, and state labs don't have freezers that go nearly that low, but Sayan is now saying that is a temporary issue. Since the development was so fast, we were not able to work out better, more stable conditions, he said. We believe that in the second half of 2020, we will have come up with a formulation which is comparable to any other type of vaccine. Pfizer and BioNTech say final analysis shows coronavirus vaccine is 95% effective with no safety concerns. From CNN's Maggie Fox and Amanda Seeley. A final analysis of the Phase 3 trial of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine shows it was 95% effective in preventing infections, even in older adults, and caused no serious safety concerns, the company said Wednesday. The company counted 170 cases of coronavirus infection among volunteers who took part in the trial. It said 162 infections were in people who got placebo or plain saline shots, while 8 cases were in participants who got the actual vaccine. That works out to an efficacy of 95%, Pfizer said. The data show Pfizer's initial claim of a better than 90% efficacy, a claim that stunned and pleased health officials and vaccine developers last week, holds up. efficacy was consistent across age, race, and ethnicity demographics. The observed efficacy in adults over 65 years of age was over 94%, Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech said in a joint statement. There were 10 severe cases of COVID-19 observed in the trial, with 9 of the cases occurring in the placebo group and 1 in the BNT162B2 vaccinated group. That is the experimental name for the vaccine. An independent group has been keeping an eye on results and side effects. To date, the Data Monitoring Committee for the study has not reported any serious safety concerns related to the vaccine, the company said. The only grade 3 severe solicited adverse event greater than or equal to 2% in frequency after the first or second dose was fatigue at 3.7% following dose 2, the company said. Older adults tended to have fewer adverse events, and those they had were milder. Pfizer said it will seek U.S. Food and Drug Administration emergency use authorization within days. And here's another short article on that. German pharmaceutical company BioNTech, which has been working on a COVID-19 vaccine with U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer, will file paperwork for emergency use of its vaccine in the United States on Friday, the company CEO Uğur Şahin told CNN in an interview on Wednesday. Earlier today, Pfizer announced that a final analysis of the Phase 3 trial of its coronavirus vaccine shows it was 95% effective in preventing infections, even in older adults, and caused no serious safety concerns. FDA sets meeting for Vaccine Advisory Committee, from CNN's Elizabeth Cohen. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has called for a meeting of its Vaccine Advisory Committee in 3 weeks to consider whether the agency should authorize 2 COVID-19 vaccines, according to a source familiar with the process. The FDA reached out last week to members of its Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, a group of outside experts, asking them to hold December 8th, 9th, and 10th for meetings, according to the source. The agency could make a decision at the end of the meeting on December 10th about whether to issue emergency use authorization for the vaccines, the source said. Two companies, Pfizer and Moderna, say they will soon apply to the FDA for authorization for their COVID-19 vaccines, both of which has shown in initial data to be more than 90% effective against COVID-19. It will make sense that in all likelihood, the FDA will consider both applications together, the source said, considering that both vaccines use the same technology and appear to have very similar safety and efficacy results from their large-scale Phase 3 clinical trials. If the FDA authorizes the vaccines, they can then be immediately distributed to states, according to a presentation made last month at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, no one can be vaccinated until a CDC advisory committee reviews the data, recommends the vaccine, and says which groups will receive it first. If the FDA authorizes the vaccines, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, an independent panel of experts, will meet within 24 to 48 hours, according to a CDC spokesperson. At that meeting, the committee will determine if everyone should get the vaccine or if some people should be excluded. It will also decide which groups should get the vaccine first. We have all been alerted on ACIP. We should be very flexible with our calendars because it's likely there won't be a lot of advance notice given for this meeting. It will be done very, very quickly, said Dr. William Schaffner, a committee member. Once ACIP issues its recommendations, vaccinations can be given. Next steps. The nation's top infectious disease physician, Dr. Anthony Fauci, told CNN earlier this week the first vaccinations in the U.S. could take place towards the latter part of December. States are currently working out details on running vaccination clinics. The Pfizer vaccine is particularly complicated since it must be stored at minus 75 degrees Celsius, and doctors' offices and pharmacies typically do not have freezers that go that low. The first groups expected to receive the vaccine are healthcare workers, the elderly, essential workers such as police officers, and those with underlying medical conditions. Coronavirus immunity in some people may last more than 6 months, early research suggests. From CNN's Health, Jacqueline Howard. Immunity to the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 can last for at least 6 months, and possibly much longer, perhaps even years, when all the components of the body's immune memory are taken into consideration, early research suggests. The preprint paper published on Monday to the online server biroxiv.org appears to contradict previous research that has found immunity to the novel coronavirus wanes over time based on measurements of antibodies or protein components of the immune system. Yet the new study, which has not been peer-reviewed or published in a scientific journal, involves analyzing multiple compartments of immune memory over time, antibodies, B cells, and T cells, among other features of immune memory. About the study. The study included 185 adults, ages 19 to 81 in the United States, who had recovered from COVID-19. Most of the adults had mild disease. The researchers from the La Jolla Institute for Immunology, University of California, San Diego, and Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai analyzed blood samples from the adults collected at various points following the onset of symptoms, with some collected more than 6 months later. In the blood samples, researchers examined components of immune memory. They found that antibodies were durable, with only modest declines emerging at 6 to 8 months, but noted that there was about a 200-fold range in the level of antibody responses among the adults. The researchers also found that memory B cells were detected in almost all COVID-19 cases, and there appeared to be an increase in memory B cells over time. B cell memory to some other infections has been observed to be long-lived, including 60-plus years after smallpox vaccination or 90-plus years after infection with influenza, the researchers wrote in their study. The researchers identified two types of T cells, and their data suggests that T cell memory might reach a more stable plateau or slowly decay phase later than the first 6 months post-infection, they wrote. Remember, the study comes with limitations, including that more research is needed to determine whether similar findings would emerge among a larger group of people across more time points. With possible vaccine on the horizon, U.S. is likely in last big surge of the pandemic's toughest phase, from CNN's Christina Maxoris. The United States is likely in the last big surge before a possible COVID-19 vaccine can start to offer help in the coming months, one expert says. But for now, the country is continuing to set grim case and hospitalization records, and the pandemic shows no signs of slowing down. The months ahead are going to look better than the weeks ahead, former U.S. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Dr. Mark McClellan said at a Tuesday event hosted by Duke University. Things are going to start gradually getting better, he said. Won't be past this for still months to come, but it will start getting better by early 2021, he said, with the help of a vaccine. His projection comes at the heels of more good news out of vaccine trials, with Moderna announcing this week its vaccine is more than 94% effective, and Pfizer CEO saying the company is preparing to file for emergency use authorization for their own vaccine. But it also comes amid a scary time for the country. For at least 15 days straight, the U.S. has reported more than 100,000 daily infections. About 76,830 people are hospitalized with the virus nationwide, according to the COVID Tracking Project. That's the highest number since the pandemic's start. And each day, hundreds of Americans continue to lose their battle against COVID-19, with at least 11 days this month topping a 1,000 daily death toll. FDA authorizes first rapid COVID-19 self-test for home diagnosis. From CNN Health's Shelby Lynn Erdman. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has issued an emergency use authorization for the first self-test for COVID-19 that can provide rapid results at home. The Lucira COVID-19 All-in-One Test Kit is a molecular single-use test available by prescription for self-diagnosis of the coronavirus, the agency said Tuesday. It uses a molecular amplification technology to search for signs of the coronavirus's genetic material. How does it work? The kit includes a sterile swab, a sample vial, a test unit, batteries, and a plastic disposable bag. The user first needs to self-collect a nasal swab sample and insert it into the vial, which then enters the test unit where it is analyzed. The results are displayed on the test unit by a color change in the LED indicators, according to the FDA. Who can use it? The new test is authorized for people aged 14 and older with suspected COVID-19, and people under 13 when performed by a healthcare provider. It is also authorized for use in point-of-care settings, such as a doctor's office, hospitals, urgent care centers, and emergency rooms for all ages, but must be collected by a healthcare provider, the FDA said. While COVID-19 diagnostic tests have been authorized for at-home collection, this is the first that can be fully self-administered and provide results at home, FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn said in a statement. This new testing option is an important diagnostic advancement to address the pandemic and reduce the public burden of disease transmission, Hahn added. And now, here is an article from CNN. Recovering COVID-19 patients struggle to return to normal after hospital discharge, study finds. By Shelby Lynn Erdman and Jacqueline Howard. Published November 14th. Surviving COVID-19 is hard enough for those who get seriously ill from the disease, but returning to normal is a struggle too, according to new research that found survivors were likely to face health and financial hardships even months later. A team of scientists led by Dr. Vineet Chopra of the University of Michigan Health System looked at 488 COVID-19 patients treated and released from hospitals in Michigan. They surveyed them about 2 months after their release, between March 16th and July 1st. A third of the survivors reported ongoing health issues, such as cough, new or worsening conditions, and persistent loss of taste or smell, the researchers reported this week in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine. Nearly half said they were emotionally affected by their illness, and a small number, 28, sought mental health care after discharge. Another 36% reported at least a mild financial impact from their hospitalization. Of those employed before their illness, 40% said they either lost their job or were too sick to return to work. Just over a quarter of those who returned to work reported reduced hours or modified responsibilities. For most patients who survived, ongoing morbidity, including the inability to return to normal activities, physical and emotional symptoms, and financial loss was common, Chopra's team wrote. These data confirm that the toll of COVID-19 extends well beyond hospitalization, the study concluded. The study had limitations. The survey only covered 488 out of more than 1,600 patients whose records were originally tracked. A third of those 1,600 patients died, the researchers reported. CDC data. Hospitalization rates among blacks and Latinos about four times higher than whites. COVID-19 hospitalization rates are significantly higher among the black, Latino, and Alaska Native or Native American populations in the United States, compared with Asian and white people. New study from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's weekly COVID-19 surveillance report show. The data shows that between March 1st and November 7th, the hospitalization rate among the Hispanic or Latino population was 444.6 per 100,000 people. The hospitalization rate among Alaska Natives or Native Americans was 430.9 per 100,000. Among the black population, it was 412.2 per 100,000. The hospitalization rate among Asian or Pacific Islanders and whites were 132.5 and 106.2 per 100,000, respectively, according to the data, which was updated on Friday. When examining overall age-adjusted rates by race and ethnicity, the rate for Hispanic and Latino persons was approximately 4.2 times the rate among non-Hispanic white persons, the CDC report said. Rates for non-Hispanic American Indian or Alaska Native persons and non-Hispanic black persons were approximately 4.1 and 3.9 times the rate among non-Hispanic white persons, respectively. The data comes from a surveillance system consisting of 250 acute care hospitals in 14 states, the CDC says. Since the end of September, overall weekly hospitalization rates in the United States have increased, driven primarily by a rise in rates among adults ages 50 and older, according to the CDC. Additionally, weekly hospitalization rates among children have had a two-week sustained increase from October 24th to November 7th, the CDC said. And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, November 18th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up next, we'll bring you a health magazine to fill the rest of the hour until we get to 2 o'clock, at which time we'll bring you national news from USA Today. Following that at 3, of course, we'll have our local news broadcast. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Myers says measures needed to curb numbers. Family seeks answers in teen's death. City mask mandate fails in 6-1 vote. From the Odessa American, community should be alarmed. NTO student gets letter from Trump. City schedules runoff for mayor and council seats. Those local newspaper articles and more will come up at 3 o'clock, and then at 6, the Wall Street Journal. At 7 o'clock tonight, of course, we'll bring you our Center Solutions podcast, and that will focus on homelessness during the pandemic. We'll be back tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much for joining us. Be well and have a great day.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The City of Odessa, in partnership with the University of Texas Permian Basin, has scheduled the second round of free mobile COVID-19 testing events at the following times, dates, and locations. September 23rd, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., UTPB Park Soccer Field Parking, East Loop 338 and Highway 191. September 30th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Sherwood Park, East 49th Street and Cordova Street Parking Lot. October 14th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Floyd Gwynn Park Parking Lot, 1015 North County Road West. Events are for City of Odessa and Ector County residents. First come, first serve. For more information, call 557-6557. That's 557-6557.
Our Thanksgiving series continues Thursday on the Noon Book Hour as we begin reading Thanksgiving by Janet Ivanovich. In Williamsburg, Virginia, Megan Murphy is a potter and historical greeter who ran away from her hometown to start over. She had been left at the altar by her previous fiancé. She wanted a new beginning. And now, when it comes to men, Megan Murphy has an aversion to "I do." So when she discovered a floppy-eared rabbit gnawing on the hem of her skirt, she meant to give its careless owner a piece of her mind. But Dr. Patrick Hunter was too attractive to stay mad at for long. Add in a cozy colonial cottage and the world's biggest turkey, and the two are soon making Thanksgiving dinner for their families. Thanksgiving by Janet Ivanovich, starting Thursday at noon and Friday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 70 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Due to unforeseen circumstances, our regularly scheduled program will not be heard at this time. We hope you enjoy this special presentation on GARS.
With all my hand washing and social distancing and mask wearing, it seems like I haven't asked my immune system to do much for me in the last 7 months. I admit, it's been rather nice not to have a cold or two or three turn into sinus infections. Of course, my immune system has been healing my cuts and scrapes, which happen a lot as an avid vegetable gardener, and it has been balancing things out with my allergies, not letting bug bites get to me, and generally looking after me through its vast network, even though it hasn't had to deal with much in the way of the common cold and flu. Today, we're going to read about why the human immune system might be better at fighting COVID-19 than some studies may lead us to believe. And we will also have time to read about how nanoscopic pathogens, other than the coronavirus, can lay you up in bed for weeks, and how to prevent that from happening. Let's start out with a Canadian article from CBC News. This was written by Adam Miller and published on October 31st, 2020. This is titled, Why Our Immune System Might Be Better at Fighting COVID-19 Than We Think. There's a lot of confusion and speculation about immunity to COVID-19 at the moment. You may have seen the headlines this week implying that antibodies the immune system creates to fight off the coronavirus decline rapidly after infection, jeopardizing the hope for long-term immunity from the virus. But the issue is both more complicated than it may seem and more hopeful. The preprint study, which has not undergone peer review, found the number of people with detectable antibodies in their blood in England fell from 6% of the population at the end of June to just 4.4% by mid-September. The researchers concluded there was decreasing population immunity and increasing risk of reinfection, and that the community study of 365,000 patients clearly showed detectable antibodies were in decline. But while the study and its discouraging conclusion made headlines around the world, experts say there's a lot more to consider before we can definitively say coronavirus antibodies don't last long enough to protect us. One key factor to keep in mind is that it's not uncommon for immunity to drop after an infection, said Allison Kelvin, an assistant professor at Dalhousie University and virologist at the Canadian Centre for Vaccinology, evaluating Canadian vaccines with the VIDO Intervac lab in Saskatoon. Simply showing that antibodies decline after an infection does not simply mean we are no longer protected, she said. Our immune system is more complicated than that, which is a good thing. A drop in detectable antibodies is actually expected after an infection, and that high levels of antibodies remaining after an illness has passed could actually be a bad thing, Kelvin said. Typically, we would associate high levels of an activated immune response when there is no threat with more of an autoimmune disease, she said. So we do want to see somewhat of a decline to know that our bodies are in check after we've cleared the virus. The other important factor is that the immune system can actually remember how to make new antibodies when needed to fight off future infections by storing types of protective white blood cells in the body called B cells. Kelvin said just because there aren't detectable antibodies in the blood doesn't mean we don't have reservoirs of these immune memory cells stored in other parts of our body, like in our bone marrow. That's usually where your memory B cells would kind of hide out, waiting for another exposure, Kelvin said, because you're not going to have these circulating antibodies when you're not being exposed. You kind of need to put them away for when you need them. Another study published this week in the journal Science and peer-reviewed may have added to the confusion over immunity to the coronavirus. It looked at antibody responses in the plasma samples of more than 30,000 COVID-19 patients in New York City's Mount Sinai Health System between March and October. It came to a much different conclusion than the preprint study, that more than 90% of patients produced moderate to high levels of antibodies that were both powerful enough to neutralize the virus and lasted for many months after infection. One difference in the two studies is that the preprint looked at patients ranging from asymptomatic to severe, while the published study focused on hospitalized patients who were primarily symptomatic. There seems to be some type of split where milder cases after infection don't have this notable increase in antibody responses for long periods of time, Kelvin said. That might be more evident in people who have more severe infection. Researchers in the New York study concluded that the antibodies they found were likely produced by long-lived plasma cells in the bone marrow, something that backs up the idea that dormant immune memory B cells could be hiding there. This study suggests that the majority of those people infected with SARS-CoV-2 will produce protective antibodies, which will likely protect from reinfection, Kelvin said. This would support the notion that we will be able to produce a vaccine that is safe and leads to a protective immune response. After an exposure to a virus from either an infection or a vaccination, the body goes through what's called an expansion phase, where these memory immune cells produce antibodies in response to it, something Kelvin likens to climbing a mountain. Once the body believes it has cleared the infection and reached the top of the mountain, those antibodies then start to decline during what is known as the contraction phase, the start of the descent down the mountain. As you get to the bottom of the mountain, the body moves into a memory phase, where the most effective antibodies get stored until the next exposure, like the experience you might have to better climb the mountain next time. At that point, B cells are not thought to be detectable in the bloodstream, instead going into immune reservoirs in the body such as bone marrow, which means they could be missed by researchers only focusing on antibodies in the blood. We don't yet know what level of these antibodies is actually needed to prevent infection, said Dr. Lenora Saxinger, an infectious disease specialist and associate professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Alberta. But there are lots of examples of low antibody levels getting boosted up quickly when you are re-exposed to an infectious agent due to B cell memory pumping out antibodies on re-exposure. Another tool our body uses to help fight infection are T cells, a different type of white blood cell stored in the body that can also attack the virus the next time they encounter it, but are a separate arm of the immune system. A recent paper published in the journal Cell found that a balance of both T cells and B cells produced in the body could lead to a better outcome after infection from the coronavirus, and Kelvin said understanding more about T cell immunity could be helpful for vaccine development. One positive note is that memory B cells, which have the capacity to protect against future infections, have already been detected in both symptomatic and asymptomatic COVID-19 patients, as pointed out in another study published in the journal Nature this week. Kelvin said COVID-19 patients who develop severe disease or die after being infected with the virus may have a lower ability to generate antibodies because it is possibly targeting and destroying those B cells. These results would support the idea that herd immunity through natural infection will not lead to long-lasting immunity, she said, which will instead keep our vulnerable populations at risk of death. Other coronaviruses, such as SARS and MERS, can also provide hints as to how long the dormant antibodies might stick around, waiting to protect us from infection down the road. In both SARS and MERS, for years after antibodies were no longer detectable, immune memory cells geared for specific responses to both viruses could still be found in recovered patients, said Dr. David Naylor, co-chair of the federal government's immunity task force. Bottom line, it seems really likely, based on millions of people infected, the duration of the epidemic, and the still very small percentage of reinfections, that there is pretty durable immunity to SARS-CoV-2 after an initial infection. It's important to keep in mind that research showing declining antibodies over time does not necessarily mean there is somehow less of a chance that we'll be able to develop safe and effective vaccines in the coming months. There's still lots to learn about durability of immunity, Naylor said. No one expects any of the vaccine candidates to grant indefinite immunity, and they may work more like an annual flu shot, he said. The immediate issue is whether vaccines will achieve and maintain enough overall immunity to keep spread under control so we can get on with our lives. Regardless, Kelvin says that immunity gained from vaccines is safer than achieving it through rampant infections, a concept also known as herd immunity. More work is needed to understand how long immunity lasts, she said, adding that while a vaccine might not offer long-lasting protection either, it doesn't come with the same risk of death faced by patients with COVID-19. So having a safe and effective vaccine would be the best way of controlling outbreaks. We're going to move now to Health Magazine. They've done a special edition on immunity, and this is an article titled The Secret Life of Germs, written by Jancy Dunn and Noel LeBlanc. During the age of COVID-19, it's easy to panic with every cough, sniffle, or aching throat. When it comes to fighting germs beyond coronavirus, knowledge is power. We all know to wash our hands frequently while singing Happy Birthday twice. So let's dig deeper and tackle the more mystifying questions about germs. For instance, how quickly can a germ that you picked up at work cause intestinal distress? If someone sneezes in your face? Okay, let's get down to it. Influenza virus causes the flu, can live for an hour or more in the air and up to 9 hours on hard surfaces such as metal desks, counters, and faucets. On porous surfaces like towels, it dies within a few hours. Although, if your family uses a communal hand towel in the kitchen, and who doesn't, that's enough to do the job. How it spreads. Through the air, when a person talks, sneezes, or coughs, and bodily contact, such as a handshake. The flu germ typically incubates for 1 to 4 days, with most people starting to feel sick after 2 days. Typical scenario, someone sneezes on the ATM right before you walk in, you use the keypad, then scratch your nose. Boom. Not so fun fact. You can be contagious with the flu a day before symptoms show up, so you might not even know you're sick as you're spreading it around town. Rhinovirus causes the common cold. Can live for up to 24 hours on hard surfaces like plastic and stainless steel. How it spreads. Direct contact with an infected person often through the hands or breathing in droplets from someone who has just sneezed, talked, or coughed. After being exposed to germs, most people catch a cold within 1 to 3 days. Typical scenario, you're in the crowded waiting area at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the sniffly, snuffly person standing next to you coughs in your direction. Not so fun fact, there are more than 100 subtypes of rhinovirus, which is why you can recover from one cold and then get another immediately afterward. Norovirus causes the stomach flu. Can live for, wait for it, up to weeks on hard surfaces, and it can even survive common household disinfectants. It is easily spread in situations where people are in close contact, says Graham Snyder, MD, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. For some infections, you need large numbers of the germ to make somebody sick, he says. But for norovirus, you need just a few, so it's easy to transmit. That's why you end up with trouble, for example, on a cruise ship. How it spreads, touching an infected surface, sharing utensils with infected people, or eating contaminated foods. Symptoms can appear in 12 hours. Typical scenario. You try a bite of your friend's pasta at lunch, and she texts an hour later to tell you she's throwing up. It's coming for you, lady. Not so fun fact. Norovirus is a fecal-oral pathogen, meaning microparticles from poo have somehow made it into your mouth. Kinda gross, I know, says Kelly Reynolds, PhD, an environmental microbiologist at the University of Arizona. It's usually either from contaminated hands or somebody who was sick preparing your food. Hepatitis A virus causes hepatitis A. Can live for several hours on human hands and up to several days on household surfaces. It's also persistent, enduring freezing temperatures and staying infectious in water for up to a year. How it spreads. From person to person, usually when someone ingests contaminated food or water. It can also spread if you come into close personal contact with an infected individual, such as during intercourse. Typical scenario. You eat something that was prepared by a person who has hepatitis A or who wasn't using sanitary practices, such as washing hands after going to the restroom or touching other contaminated areas. Not so fun fact, symptoms can take between 15 and 50 days to appear after you contract the virus. Your kids might not show symptoms at all. Dengue virus causes dengue fever. Can live for, dengue virus spreads only through mosquito bites, so it doesn't survive on surfaces alone. How it spreads? Through the bite of a mosquito carrying one of the dengue viruses. You can't get it from person-to-person contact. Typical scenario, you travel abroad in a tropical region populated with the Aedes aegypti mosquito and get bitten. It can take up to 5 days to show symptoms, and dengue fever can last for a week. Not so fun fact, once infected, you build immunity and won't be infected with that particular virus again. However, there are 4 different dengue viruses, and it's possible to contract all 4 in your lifetime. E. coli bacteria causes intestinal infection. Can live for up to a day in food, but it can't survive on hard surfaces or skin. How it spreads? Through food or water that's been contaminated from unsanitary practices or improper food handling, as well as through consuming foods that haven't been stored at the right temperature. Typical scenario, you make a ground beef burger, but like it on the rare side, so you don't cook it to an internal temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit. In a hurry, you throw on some raw lettuce and tomato that you didn't wash properly. Feta is your favorite cheese, but you didn't check to see if it was made with pasteurized milk. Not so fun fact, you're more likely to come into contact with E. coli during the summer, June to September, and symptoms of intestinal infection can take up to 10 days to appear. Our last one, Listeria bacteria causes invasive listeriosis. Can live for up to 20 to 30 days on hard surfaces. It can grow when stored above 40 degrees Fahrenheit. How it spreads. Eating food contaminated with the Listeria monocytogenes germ or not cleaning surfaces that the bacteria has come into contact with. Typical scenario. You drink unpasteurized milk or eat soft cheese made with unpasteurized milk. You consume raw or undercooked hot dogs and deli meats or refrigerated smoked seafood. Outbreaks have also been linked to produce such as raw sprouts, room temperature cantaloupe, and celery. Not so fun fact, sprouts grow in warmth and humidity, so do bacteria. Washing sprouts will not remove bacteria, so be sure to fully cook them. 8 ways to avoid germs. Number 1, hand sanitizer and hand wipes. Solid soldiers in the war on germs. Alcohol-based hand san and wipes are lifesavers in those instances when you aren't near a sink, but they won't kill norovirus, salmonella, E. coli, or MRSA. Washing your hands with soap and water is always the best way to go, says Dr. Snyder, and check the hand san label. It should contain at least 60% alcohol to be effective, according to the CDC. 2. The germiest thing in your office is not in the bathroom. Repeatedly, we find the coffee pot handle seems to be the first item contaminated in the office and the one people don't necessarily think to disinfect, says Reynolds. Even so, it's no reason to ghost on Mr. Coffee. Clean things often, disinfect where you can, but the real route is from your hand to your mouth, says Reynolds. If that cold or flu-causing germ doesn't come into contact with your face, it's not going to go anywhere, and you break the chain of transmission. So, while you're in the pantry, wash your hands. 3. Your eyes are a window to so many foul germs. Germs typically enter your body through the eyes, nose, and mouth. Reynolds says, and eyes are the most vulnerable. Your nose and mouth have far more defense mechanisms, with nose hairs, mucus, and being able to cough. Your eyes have almost no immune system, nor do they have immune cells, she says. Got that? Do not touch your eyes. 4. Clean your phone pronto. Cell phones carry 10 times as many bacteria as most toilet seats, according to researchers at the University of Arizona. Some of the nastiest, gnarliest germs can linger on touch screens, and Americans check their phones about 80 times a day, one survey found. Microbiologist Charles Gerber, known as Dr. Germ, recommends degerming devices with a microfiber cloth that's been lightly dampened with a solution of 40% rubbing alcohol and 60% water, then drying with a fresh microfiber cloth. Another common sense way to keep phone germs to a minimum? Don't take it into the loo with you. Seriously, no call is that important. 5. Tell your kids not to share water bottles. My kids will grab anybody's water bottle and take a drink, says Reynolds, a mom of 3, and we know water bottles in general, even your own, can become heavily contaminated. We find a lot of fecal E. coli on the spouts. Her advice? Get those things out of their backpacks, sanitize them in the dishwasher, and dry them out so they're not transmitting germs. 6. The grossest thing about your washer dryer. There's no non-gross way to say this, so no matter how thoroughly you wipe, the average person has a tenth of a gram of fecal residue in his or her underwear. And if you're throwing a sick person's undies in the family wash, Reynolds' research found that one germy item in the washer spread to 90% of the wash. Most germs that cause colds and flu, she adds, actually survive the wash cycle. So, when you're transferring damp clothes from the washer to the dryer, you're potentially getting all kinds of bacteria on your hands. Wash your hands thoroughly afterward, she says, adding that the best way to kill the bugs is by jacking the dryer to high heat for at least 28 minutes. 7. Don't track germs through the house. In one study, Gerber found 421,000 units of bacteria on the outside of shoes. On 96% of them, the researchers also identified coliform bacteria, which is found in bird turd and dog mess, and on your floor if people waltz around with their shoes on. Lastly, number 8, little steps, big germ avoidance. After washing your hands in a public restroom, place a paper towel over the faucet handle when you turn off the water. Stop biting your nails. It's a direct germ transfer system. And get vaccinated. We have here Pets and the Immune System by Courtney Mifsud. Your fluffy housemate could be helping you stay healthy. Growing research suggests that owning a pet, specifically dogs or cats, benefits the immune system. Pets can even help kids build immunity before they're born. Science points to the complex network of bacteria, fungi, and viruses that makes up the indoor microbiome in our homes that may actually help prevent diseases instead of cause them. Rather than trying to filter out every last speck of dirt, letting the body be exposed to a diverse array of indoor germs can help the immune system develop properly. And as all pet owners know, nothing helps bring more dirt into the house than a mud-rolling, paw-print-smearing pet. And research suggests that Fido's filth can help keep us healthy. A 2011 study published in the journal Clinical and Experimental Allergy collected information from 566 children and their parents about the children's exposure to pets in the home and their history of allergies. The study also took blood samples, and when the subjects turned 18, they were tested for certain immune system antibodies that fight off pet allergens. The teenagers who had lived with a cat during their first year of life had a 48% lower risk of developing a cat allergy than those who did not have pets. The teenage boys who had a dog had a 50% lower risk of dog allergy. Dirt is good, the study's lead researcher, Ganessa Waginka, Ph.D., told Health at the time of the study's publication. Your immune system, if it's busy with exposures early on, stays away from the allergic immune profile. More recent research suggests that the immune connection develops even earlier than birth. A 2017 study published in Microbiome found that children born into homes with pets have higher levels of gut microbes that help protect against allergies and other diseases. The study compared fecal samples from 746 infants from Canada. Some of the babies were born from families with pets, the majority of which were dogs. Some were from families who had pets in the home during the pregnancy, but not once the baby was born, and others from families that had no recent pets at all. The study found that infants from households with pets had twice the amount of two bacteria, Acilla spira and Ruminococcus, that have been linked to a reduced risk of developing childhood allergies. And that is the end of the article. There are many more articles in this special edition of Health Magazine called Immunity, Protect Yourself. And I'm going to take away from these readings that I need to put my mask, which generally I've put in the wash, but then not put in the dryer because the dryer is pretty hard on fabrics. But it seems like that's what I should be doing, is putting it into a hot dryer. So I will change my ways. I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today, and I hope you will please stay well. And come back next week for more healthy living ideas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is offering curbside adoptions, vaccines, warmer, and more. Shelter hours are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only one person is allowed in the office and kennels at this time. For applications, vaccine, or additional information, call 381-5503 or 257-4311 or email shelter@odessahumanesociety.org. To see current pets available or to private message the shelter, visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
The Center Solutions Podcast with Centers for Children and Families CEO and licensed therapist Christy Edwards and Director of Marketing and Development Melanie Size, along with your host, Recording Library's Executive Director Bailey Hennis.
We have all experienced something, whether it's fear, anxiety, loneliness, depression. Everyone has had an effect.
So now we are getting a little glimpse of what these homebound seniors experience every single day.
We always connect with people. The nurse comes from the word nurture. We have real connections with people.
This is another one of those things that it does not matter who you are. And when you compound that with coming home to an empty refrigerator, mental health and food insecurity go together so closely.
Christy is our therapist, and she's going to tell us about coping mechanisms on how to deal with everything going on.
We know there's a lot on your mind, but start kind of doing a self-check of how you're doing emotionally before it gets to the point that everybody is calling saying, I'm in a crisis.
I joke that it's kind of like we've been sentenced to this time at home and we got to cross those days off.
For us in our life, we're very spiritual. Being able to have that reconnection, because, I mean, we can't go to church right now, but pray about it's been also another thing for us. It's been a stronghold to help.
The Center Solutions Podcasts, Tuesday mornings at 10, Wednesday nights at 7, and Friday mornings at 5 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know as love. You have words with him, and your future's looking thin, but these things your hearts can rise. Once in a while he won't call, but it's all in the game. Soon he'll be there at your side with a sweet bouquet.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 71 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
It's 2 p.m.
Prospects dim for election lawsuits. A federal appeals court ruling may have torpedoed several federal lawsuits that seek to overturn President Donald Trump's all-but-certified defeat by former Vice President Joe Biden. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled Friday that Pennsylvania voters in a congressional